On this week's show, the data dilemma for owners in construction with Nick Caravella from Avocado. In this week's news, AI breaches gets interesting and more.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, we're back. Nathan Wood back on the microphone with me. How are you, man?
Oh, man, it's good to be home. Although got back from the University of Texas, unfortunate loss to the Georgia Bulldogs. Poor Josh Bone out there is, I'm sure, still celebrating, but we're good to be home.
Good to be home. Saw that picture with you in the morning.
Game day.
Game day behind you. But yeah, I was out in the woods, so I did not hear about it until yesterday morning when I got back. College football is going to be interesting this year.
Oh, man. It's what's crazy is all the drones and everything that they do. I mean, SEC, they put a lot of money into the whole fanfare thing. It's nuts.
That's awesome. And it's, you know, hey, it's a great year for it to go to the 12-team playoff because it's any given Saturday these days. So, but this show is about ConTech, and we got Nick with us. Nick, how you doing, man?
Doing well. Great, glad to be home as well, too. I just got back from Autodesk University. And fun fact, yesterday was my birthday. I turned 36, so I am officially an emerged professional by most community standards now. So I think a great day to be kicking this off with my career here.
Awesome. Thanks. You know, day after the birthday, feeling revved up, ready to go off of Autodesk University. One of the big ones of the year. Lots of FOMO last week. I did not get to go. So we'll have to pick your brain a little bit on what you learned from there, what some of the major learned lessons were. We're going to jump into this interview, but before we do, remember, we're back on YouTube. Check us out, youtube.com/@TheConTech Crew. Look for our new shorts. Look for some changes coming up. Smash that subscribe button. Are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the ConTech Crew. That's right. We're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@theconTechCrew.com to learn more. All right. We're back with Nick. Avocado, not to be confused with avocado, like I almost did on the intro. Very close. So Avocado. You got a long history in the business, though. So tell us a little bit about you and how you got here.
Yeah, so started out, grew up in New Jersey, architect by trade. I went to New Jersey Institute of Tech, worked at a variety of firms, small and large, six people up to Gensler. So got to see a lot of things, good, bad, ugly, and otherwise. And I think all that exposure in the different ways of people, the way we design buildings really helped kind of start to highlight my journey into the tech sphere. The last company that I worked with, that brought me into tech was I was looking for a new solution to help us manage our delivery process better. I was doing a lot of restaurant jobs, 4-week turnarounds. By the time the accountant could get me the hours, project was delivered. Was I alive? Did I make money? Who knew? And I really wanted to get away from that fun game of trying to figure out how to administer our work better, while making more time to get to design. So I found a tech startup. Nathan, actually, we caught up afterwards, but I was working at this tech startup for a while. They showed me how I could kind of connect my planning to budgets and all the performance of buildings. Love what they had to do. But then I also learned the side of technology, where this is an entirely different industry. So there was a disconnect between the way our industry works and the processes and the contracts that go between them, and the idea that technology could just connect everything and make it better. So I had that aha realization. I said, you know, we don't need a shiny new tool. We got a lot of really great stuff here. How do we get them to all work together better? Nathan actually introduced me to Avi of Avi Kato, where the namesake comes from. And one thing led to another. And here I am. I work with owners now to help them get more out of the data that our teams create in the design and construction world.
Well, that is an awesome history. And it's an important one because most people just keep creating shiny toys and chasing shiny toys. But I think your experience with the difficulties along the way and also understanding it might not be that it's not working. It's just that it's not connected and working together. So in concert. But you also had an opportunity as a designer to learn a little bit more than most say or have a different view on the process in the AECO industry. So talk a little bit more for us, for those listening, kind of about what you learn in the process sitting in the architect seat that might give you a different view where you're sitting today.
Yeah, I think that's a great question because I think I don't feel my job has changed too much. I like to tell people I move from how people move through buildings to how data moves through technology. And all of it's a design problem at the end of the day. I firmly believe that if I'm not getting the outcomes I want, my design is wrong. And that means going back to the drawing board, figuring out the process and how to kind of improve the way we go about that. So in architecture, I often joke, I hated submittals so much, I made them my full-time job. Getting information from one system, having to fat finger it into my system as well as an owner system, and then, you know, pulling out my rubber stamp and doing 20 minutes of filing for 5 minutes of work. And that was something that was just incredibly frustrating at the time. I realized how important and critically important the data was, but didn't understand why at this, like I was an architect, I want to design buildings. I don't want to upload Excel sheets and all this other stuff. And so I started to ask why. And I think throughout my career, there's a few times that I really started to have this aha moment about process, which I think is the biggest issue with technology adopted in today is our processes for delivering buildings has not really changed too much. We create BIM, but for the ultimate result of creating the drawings, filing permits, instead of creating BIM that happens to make drawings. And I really like that, you know, everybody knows Simon Sinek, why, and Apple challenging their quote of like, we believe in thinking differently. We want to challenge the status quo. We just happen to make great computers. And I think that's the way our industry needs to start thinking about things is we care about making the best buildings and all of that stuff, but we need to care about the data too. And we need to happen to make great drawings and happen to make great models that can be used for all of these things. So I feel we've been shoehorned into this path of traditional delivery, and it's preventing us from adopting new processes and workflows that will allow us to unlock the data behind all the exchanges of all the hands on a project.
God, I love that. Cause I think it's like taking that worldview, but then still like, what can we do tomorrow to fix that? And I think we talk all the time about the Procore and Newforma RFI connector. And I often forget and need to keep coming back to the eBuilder and Procore connector that I know predates your time at Avi Kato, but I'm sure it's still something that you guys are using a lot. Tell us, I guess, for those that are not familiar, like what it does and like how kind of that fits into that you know, acting small, but in effort for that larger interoperability goal.
Yeah. So for Avi Kato, we help implement, integrate, and just unlock the power of technology for owners. We have teams who, like me, come from the construction world and people who are just complete tech gurus. And that those connectors that we build, I like to think of them as technology is something that's built for everyone. And by doing that, it's not going to be 100% tailored for you. It's going to have 80%, right? That 20% is what makes your business special. And that 20% is where your pain starts. And so generally, when you're trying to buy something out of the box, you got to tailor it. You got to make sure that it fits your system and your processes and the things that give you your competitive edge. And that's where our connectors kind of come in, because it's an integrations team. This isn't really a product, but much more a prescriptive solution to the pains that you're feeling between how your technology connects with your own systems as well as your own vendors, and how to create the right pathways to get the information you're looking for in the format that you need it. Because you know, no two companies' cost codes are the same, and there's reasons for that. And there's no, I've seen 100 different ways to submit an RFI, all of them good. So how do we enable good? How do we enable all of this good by creating better connectivity?
So interesting too, because a lot of what you see, you know, is people are trying to build APIs or build the next Workato or whatever it might be to run in the world. And you guys have taken a little bit different view of how you go about that. So talk a little bit about how the group's organized and then executes, because there's a big technology component, but you also, you know, you don't leave out the people in the process.
Yeah. And so that's where many times we work with all different systems from Procore, eBoulder, Trimble's full suite really now as they're moving toward Unity, Autodesk, even Microsoft. And I think we learned, you know, back in 2009, where disruption was cool and sexy and all that, that it's not quite as the thing that we wanted. It's painful. People have to relearn new things. You know, how do we address change at our organizations? And a lot of that times is figuring out how to create comfort in that change, how to help people move through, say, the loss that they're feeling when they're doing something new and different, and explaining to them and helping get that buy-in. And so, you know, you can change all you want, but if the people don't pick up the tool and they don't use the tool, then it was a failed mission. So getting into how people work, what do they need to succeed, and ensuring that those processes are enhanced and augmented are really critical. And this goes down to thinking about just the non-optimal work and the relationship that it has to our lives of, you know, someone who is a carpenter doesn't want to necessarily go back and plug data into a system. They want to build the wall. They want to build the casework. And so this is where stuff like field technology gets really cool, especially with field monitoring, is can we report on progress without having the person do the reporting? Let the person do the building. It's why they get up in the morning. How do we get the data out of it? And so those are the kinds of examples we look for is, you know, are we submitting, you know, a comprehensive submittal that has all of this information? Does it need to be reviewed by certain teams? Does it need to meet certain criteria? What is that entire chain of approval look like? How do we use technology to ensure that gets done without having someone play telephone all day long and figure out where the heck in this approval chain is this document? As just one example. So it really gets into the nitty gritty of like making sure that all the I's are dotted, all the T's are crossed, and that everything is looked at by all the right people. So before it's installed, you got the right thing rather than here's your day two change. You're welcome.
And I think that's such an important distinction, right, between the services that support the product itself when we talk about this messy thing of interoperability and getting all this stuff to work, is that we think that just buying a Boomi or buying a Workato or buying one of these things is going to fix it. But there's so much that goes into how you use something like that. And so you're kind of there to help guide through these very complicated things that rather than just buying it and think you can figure out yourself. Is that right?
Yeah. And we don't do it alone. I mean, we talk about this at the AACIS summit all the time around, you know, when, like, I think many times interoperability gets mistaken for like, I can just hook the fire hose up to somebody else's system and send data all day long. But the reality is, and I've learned this from working on design buildings, if I call the GC sub up and ask them a question, I'm going to run the risk of them stopping work, deciding that there's a little bit of maybe unsurety in what we're doing and start to ask questions and slow them down. And then I'm going to get an angry phone call from the GC about, hey, why are you talking to my guys? Much like the same way, if they call up my engineer and start to talk about making a change without me being privy to maybe the aesthetics or other things that that might impact. And so construction is a massive exercise in collaboration. I think the hierarchies that we establish create safeguards around productivity and making sure we're certain about the work we're doing. No one likes rework. And unfortunately, you got to go slow to go fast. And I think in the spirit of everybody trying to, you know, do the best and move things along quickly, that's where we start to open ourselves up to mistakes of what I would call, like, you know, they're well-intended, But unfortunately, goodness, maybe if we slowed down for 2 days, we would have maybe gotten it right the first time.
Yeah, it's like the intersection of IT kind of policies and practices, and then like collaboration best practices. They're always going to be somewhere like at odds, right? But it's like at least having that discussion and understanding where that messy middle is.
Yeah, and many times the IT teams are coming in with they have a set of requirements and a set of features that they're shopping for, and those requirements and features are fully divorced from how things happen. And so getting that process to be considered in the requirements part of the shopping for technology solution is challenging, because the IT guy hasn't likely done construction before. You're lucky if they have. And so getting all of that shared experience to the table, you know, I left a panel at InfraDay once, and the guy from Denver Water, Austin, he said a really brilliant thing. He said, if you want to drive collaboration at your organization, before you start any initiative, ask who else you need at the table. And I think it's always forgotten, because we're always trying to move so far, so fast, so often.
Yeah, and I would agree with you. I also think we feel like we know enough, right? We have this belief that we understand what everybody else needs, and we really don't. In fact, we have a very poor, limited vantage point into that. And I think that's interesting too, because we were talking in the pre-call, and I want to, you know, you just came back from AU. So lots of different people there. And I think the owner role in construction, and when I say that, I mean the project owner, the person who we're building for, people that we're building for, businesses that we're building for, are misunderstood. And, you know, again, as an architect, you had an opportunity to look at this differently, but now sitting in the role that you're in, and then just coming off of AU, talk a little bit about how that owner is misunderstood maybe, or just, has evolved, right? They've changed.
Yeah. I think evolved is definitely something great to touch on. And I'll start with who the owner is and kind of get into how that shape has even changed for me. Because when I started getting in business development for architecture, I remember I had the president come over to me and he said, you know, I'd really love to go into higher education in Colorado. We like to win more of that work. And I'm like, okay, great. What does that mean? What is working in higher ed? Who are the people that we talk to? And it's like, oh, go talk to the universities. Well, universities are big. They have teachers, all of these different departments. And so it's funny, because I think we oftentimes have that surface level appreciation for what an owner is as a conglomeration. But when we look at owners, it's, you know, who are the facility managers who are inheriting the work that we create and put in place? And maybe the capital planners who are really trying to understand their assets, manage their expenses, figure out, you know, all of the deferred maintenance that has been deferred for year after year after year. When are we going to prioritize it? And what does it mean to actually track that dollar spend to ensure that we're spending money on the right place, on the right teams? And so for owners, depending on, you know, how you fit within the ACO universe, you know, design teams could have multiple stakeholders. It's how do we design a better building that's going to reduce lifecycle costs? How do we design a building that's going to meet the operational needs of that building, whether it's classrooms that are better for learning, or a manufacturing plant, or a data center that's better at creating that processing power or energy or whatever it is that building's job is? And then how do we create value in that space instead of just designing a building? To me, that's where all the opportunity lies, is in understanding the owner and what their core needs sets are, and then how our work creates value in their space.
Yeah. I mean, as you're describing that, I'm envisioning like this massive web going in two directions around really a decision, right? Because all these things are a series of very expensive, very impactful decisions that an owner has to make in conjunction with the design team or the general contractor, depending on who's involved or when it is. But it's like you could follow that whole web down the architect and the general contractor, and that traditional, you know, architect hires the engineers, the GC hires all the trades, And we live in this world where those of us that live in that world go, well, why can't the trade contractors just talk directly to those engineers? Like, why does it have to go through that chain of command? And earlier you were talking about how we shouldn't go away from that, but yet it isn't the most efficient path in a digital world. Like, how do you, I mean, talk about a dilemma, right? Like, how do you make sense of that? Or what's your strategy? Or what are you preaching these days?
Yeah, this is where I think if we really were to like grab the magnifying glass, I would love to spend a year on just specifications and submittals. I said I hated it so much, but here I'm about to go commit a year to it. There's something really interesting when you think about a specification getting into the performance requirements. And this is being able to sit down with, say, a facilities group and saying, what do you need to for the building to do its job? And really defining that out on that kind of macro level, but not, say, selecting a product. Where submittals then goes in and says, hey, you know, I sent you out to buy apples. Does a Granny Smith work? And you're like, no, that's too tart for me. I really, you know, whatever it might be. Yeah. And go back and forth with figuring out what the right products and things are for that building. Now, as owners get more sophisticated, I think what's a real opportunity that we've always been steered away from in design is being prescriptive with what we do. Because if you're putting hundreds of millions of dollars of capital spend into a space, maybe knowing what products are on your building and having a strategic relationship with, say, I don't know, a Siemens for an example, could provide a whole bunch of opportunity for you. Now all your building facility managers know how to repair the same pieces of equipment. Your training material gets a little bit easier. Or maybe you find out in 5 years that that piece of equipment has been giving you hell on all of your buildings. So let's stop specifying it. And you can start to make a little bit better decisions with your data. But we've just never been in that world. We're like at the edge of like, what does it mean to have data for our buildings? And now we're going to be able to, if we have the right data strategies, build these kinds of plans that allow us to improve our building product. Which, and when you're in that world of power generation, manufacturing, data centers, and so on, you're building a product, a data center that uses the least amount of energy, but has the most amount of compute. Like, those are meaningful impacts to an industry that I don't feel look at hard enough or leverage data strongly enough today to make the best decisions to build better together.
And it's about to get bigger. I love the idea of looking at a construction project as someone that's going to have to do a job, you know, making it human. We think too much of flipping buildings and, you know, just creating a space or a house someone buys. And yeah, I mean, they make some upgrades over time, but really it's not doing much of a job. But now so much of what we build has its own primary job, whether that's healthcare, power, or data centers. And I think interesting on data centers, because that expertise is going to get really, really critical. We have limited power resources and massive compute loads with massive heat generation and requirements. So you may have been working on the human body before, but now with the modern data center, you're working on a bionic system that's going to get taxed. It's going to do way more. So it is a really opportune time, especially because they're so data centric. You're talking about a data center. All of those people that you think in your mind who build data centers are data centric. So I feel like this could be a very strategic advantage, but also a critical component.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing to level set and kind of create some of that human experience is that, you know, as anybody who's worked at a consulting agency, it's easier to consult other companies than look in on your own. And it's funny, every company I've ever worked at, it's, we are great at designing buildings, but have that firm try to design a building for their next office space and you will see all of the things fall apart. I think it's hard when you start to look inward because it starts to expose some of those gaps. And data centers too, you know, while their job is to be being as efficient as what they do, the building team, all parts of the necessary evil of doing the work. And so there's still that kind of fragmentation of when should I care? And oftentimes it's too late. And what's crazy is with AI, I think it's like we have to care now because it's creating a 10x demand on power generation. We see Microsoft getting an entire deal with a nuclear center because that's how much power it takes. So we have to move quickly and we have to think about how do we start to build those efficiencies into our buildings so that we're almost being scientific. These are all prototypes that we're continually improving on to get the next best car on the road, if you will.
Yeah, but and I think that is an interesting point, though. We were talking in pre-call about the what makes the types of owners that you work with and that certain types of owners aren't going to care. Like we complain a lot about, oh, why doesn't all the owners do BIM or do this or do that? It's like, well, if they aren't in the world where their buildings are actually performing jobs and they are, you know, service providers that need to live and breathe data, if it's a data center or people, if it's a hospital, because you've got so many folks between patients and the facility managers and the doctors and the nurses that are all using it. So I think, yeah, like that to me is where you finally can, you know, prove that return on investment. And part of like the whole other half of that decision-making, right? That just because we talk about our complaints on engineers versus trades versus whatever, it sounds like there's that whole flip side conversation for whoever that capital project manager is for those same doctors and nurses and facilities, right?
Yeah. Well, and that's, I think what gets really interesting is because if you asked me a year ago, I probably would have said first time cost developers, people who just build buildings, sell buildings and get the hell out of there. Don't care or aren't incentivized to care. I think that they might just be missing the opportunity to care because when you go, like, think about buying a building today. Do you know what you're buying? You get the set of as-builts. We all know what the state of the set of as-builts actually looks like. So do you know what you're getting? And what would it mean if you were able to sell a building that had all the units, all the different pieces of equipment, what their maintenance looked like? You know, was the car taken care of? Did it go to the shop when you needed to? Did you change the oil? Those kinds of things. And be able to say, hey, this is a Class S building that has been well maintained. Here are all the warranties that we can bring along with it. And really actually understand our building stock, because right now it's a tire kicker experience, many of its cases. And so, you know, if you don't know what you're getting and you don't know what you're looking at, you're going to inherit a whole lot of problems. And we see this in everything from home construction right to the most sophisticated buildings in the world. And we know millions and millions of dollars of work is being done on warrantied equipment. It's like an entire market in and of itself of stuff that gets paid for that otherwise was covered. And so how do we unlock this information? And so even if you're that first time cost developer, a digital twin will go a long way into saying, well, no, here is the exact state of this building that you're purchasing. And what would someone pay for that kind of clarity to understand what it is they're buying?
Yes.
Awesome. So now that's always fun. And we could probably go on for another hour or so here, but we have limited time. And I want people to know that Nick has actually, well, but you know, he's, you know, picked up the torch and joined forces in the podcast world. So if you want to learn more about it, you've actually entered in the world with the Wired to Build podcast. So where people can go listen to more, but why'd you even start it? Why join the ranks and of doing this crazy microphone thing?
Yeah. Well, so it all starts, I guess, with a little bit of a hobby. When COVID happened, I realized that we might not talk in person again for whoever knows how long. And so I was like, man, we really need to learn to digitally communicate, or at least I do. And so I like video games. And so once upon a time, I actually started a Twitch channel and learned all the video production I could have ever needed to hope for, probably too much, over the course of COVID. And it was great because it was a forgiving space. I was, you know, doing the thing that I did to relax and learning a new skill at the same time. And so I had picked up all those skills along the way. And then when I joined Avocado, I realized, you know, we have business needs as well. We have to create content. We have to market. We have to let people know what it is we're doing and how we're creating value. And I was like, man, the best way I see us doing this today is let's have conversations with people, see what they're doing. And with the whole purpose of being centered around kind of the help that we do, which is helping owners use their technology to build together better. And where the name Wired to Build came from as that kind of tongue-in-cheek of wiring up your organization to do better work. So it's been great. We interview all sorts of people. I try to get diverse perspectives, folks from the insurance world who are thinking about how, you know, the data from our buildings can actually improve the way we insure buildings. Another unsexy part of construction, I guess, but a big part of doing our business. To even talking to folks who focus on the people or different aspects of the technology. We want to just create a space for people to think about technology, their workflows, and how they can build better. So it's been a really exciting year. You know, we're growing, which is always great to see. And because I'm kind of killing two birds with one stone by every episode is content for the organization to market off of. I don't have the stress, I think, that many podcasts come with yet where's my next sponsor coming from? And in some ways, I think that is allowing us to be a little bit more explorative, too, because I'm inviting people I meet. We had Nathan on. You were our third episode, mm-hmm. I think, to talk about, you know, all the different things that come with construction and technology. And you guys inspired me. You're a huge part of it. I really enjoyed your conversations. It's like, how do I, sometimes if you're not going to get put in, you just got to step onto the field yourself. So here I am.
And I think what's great about the podcast too, is like, it's such a varied audience of guests, but the sort of the audience you're speaking to, within the avocado world is, you know, in that owner world, it is a different perspective. So like, you know, to kind of bring that articulation, you know, to filter things for that sort of an audience. Whereas if they're listening to this, you know, a lot of times we're going to go down rabbit holes that we're going to lose them. And so I think it's really important to have those niche areas.
That's actually nail on the head. Is there's an aspect of empathy I think owners need to have for the construction space and the pains or the shared pains that we have and why they exist. Because a lot of those pains are existent because we have just good process and the pain is there for a very good reason. So having empathy for all of the friction that happens in the construction process can help owners stop putting pressure on, you know, our teams to perform faster and have a little bit of empathy and respect for, like, you know, some RFIs are going to go more than 10 days because this is a VE item. So we now need to fully vet it. We need to make sure it fits within the entire system. We need to make sure that if it's a little bit heavier, we're curbs designed the right way to support this kind of stuff. There's so many moving parts in construction that, you know, it feels like a light switch decision when it gets to the owner. It's like, hey, do you want to save $5,000? This is what it'll take. But to get to that aspect, it was a lot of hair pulling out, a lot of conversations, drawings, details, and so on that, you know, to do it right, we need to do it right. And that sometimes takes time.
Yeah, and you're in the right medium where you can have those conversations. Obviously, mm-hmm. you know, we know that here, but I'm a huge fan of everybody having, I don't say everybody having a podcast, but, you know, turning to that medium to educate because, mm-hmm. you know, it's a powerful place to dive into the conversation and then, you know, memorialize it so that other people can listen in. The thing that people get wrong, I think, in construction is like every project is unique in a snowflake, but every problem is pretty much, to steal a Nathan, a shared pain. Like most every problem people have come across. And I don't think that enough people articulate it the way you did, Nick, that like some friction is good. We need it to slow us down to not make big mistakes. And, but also, you know, I said this for the last quite a few years, is like, you know, what a construction company, what a trade contractor, a modular builder, these experts in their area need to realize is they understand it. They know, and, they need to boil that down so they can explain it to an owner who might not make that decision on a regular basis, might not experience that problem regularly.
Like, no one ever gets to work with the A teams all the time. Usually there's a junior on a project and they have to learn too. And having that like empathy for each other, for me, that was a lot of opportunity because I graduated out of 2008, everybody was gone. So I was a PM, whether I chose to or not, kind of thing. And I learned a lot through that process. And what I learned is the more and more I manage projects, the more and more I'd slow things down. the biggest lesson I learned was on a $20,000 change order for a project was not my fault. It was through the submittal process. Some of the information got gummed up. I was looking to make sure it, you know, met the design standards and all those other kind of fun legalese words that you might say. But it resulted in a change of product, and that product was a lot more expensive. And we went back and forth. They kind of told the GC, I was like, hey, I'm sorry. It's like, you know, I'm not reviewing for cost at this. You submitted a substitution. You didn't tell me it was a substitution. And so my impression was there was no change to schedule budget. And heck, the quality was better. So why would I complain? And so I was like, as far as I'm concerned, you got a fell off the truck kind of deal. And we should capitalize on that too. And also, you know, goes back and forth. You figure out, you know, that was unfortunately the legal decision, is that the GC had to hold the bag on that change. But that didn't make me feel good about it. You know, I wanted to understand, you know, was there something I could have been doing better to help alleviate my partner in building that pain? And what it came down to is after that moment, I required a CSI submittal cover sheet on everything. Is there a change? Is there a cost difference? Is there a schedule difference? Check boxes to check. Because once I did that, I never had the same mistake twice. But you'd only learn that as a junior without the supervision. You break your egg and then you improve the process. And this is where technology, I think, gets cool, is because we can codify these processes and these checks to help all of us cover each other's instead of worrying about covering our own.
Yep. It very well said, and a part of the learning process everybody has to go through at some point. So it's no fun, but it's a good experience, and it's a great way to articulate that. And I'm with you. I think that's where the technology can be such a positive impact, because it can call those things out, do it really easily. So we can create friction without creating so much friction.
Yeah.
Well, with that, listen, hey, we could do this for hours. People can go catch you on Wired to Build. And we appreciate you sitting down with us, Nick, today. And you're going to stick along with us, because we're going to go into the construction technology news of the week. Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built. All right, Nathan, what you got?
Oh man. All right. We're going to have some fun with Nick on this one. So the first one here, you've heard us talk about it before. You've heard, seen Hamza on before, but I did get my copy of, Papos Builders. We got a EIN Presswire article here, new book, Papos Builders reveals how to transform the construction industry with digital technology. Again, you can read all about, but one quote I do want to pull from this, that Hamza did write in there: this book is not just a guide, it's a call to action for builders to embrace the digital tools that will propel them forward and keep them competitive in a rapidly evolving market. And again, I think, Nick, we can talk about this. I want to get your thoughts, but yes, it is a high level kind of guideline for leaders or those coming into the industry of, you know, here's where we're at, here are some of the root causes of it, and here are some ways that we can move forward. I think I'm currently on chapter 3 around communication, but I do think, you know, the way that Hamza is able to capture the essence of it, you know, bring in some personal sides to it, you know, bring in some of his real world examples, but really hit to some of the key points that we harp on all day long. But, you know, how do you make that in a concise and organized way? I know I've struggled with it. I'm impressed thus far. And Nick, how have you felt as you've been reading?
It's been an incredible read. I'm only a little bit beyond you on it. And you know, I'm hot on the, if I finish it with the way I'm feeling it now, everybody at my company should definitely get a copy. And I think you're spot on, Nathan. There is a quote, and I think it's attributed to Einstein, but I think I've gone to try and attribute it and I can't find the line. But it's like, if you can't explain it simply, you simply don't understand it, kind of thing. And Hamza does just such a fantastic job of breaking down all the different things and getting it to the point at where it's simple. And I think when we start to talk about these big complex changes we want to do in our organizations, being able to bring it into simple terms can help everybody speak the same language. Because as we talked about earlier, it's like the IT guy might not understand construction all that well, or gal. And so how do we create a, you know, Rosetta Stone where we can all speak the same language? This book is by far one of the best that I've read to date. That gets it down to a level where I think everybody could understand each other.
There's an anecdote where he was describing, you know, the guys coming to the job site and going through the safety orientation. And like, I could viscerally like see, cause I've been through that experience. I've had to lead other people through that experience. And it's like, nobody likes it, but it's just kind of a box you have to check, and it's not helpful. And so, yeah, like, how do you improve those things while still enhancing the key points that need to be made in there? Like these are not easy answers.
Well, no punches hell either. It was talked about the one guy who didn't speak English. He was going through an English training session.
Meet them where they're at, right?
Yeah. Are we checking the box or are we doing the work? And how much do we care about things like safety if we're just checking the box?
Exactly.
I really like this one because also, you know, Hamza has the opportunity with Haskell and then with DisruptTech to be a part of creating it, but then doing real world case studies and really proving it out in the field and talking about it. Because a lot of the times, you know, you've got the three of us, and Nathan, you did your time, and Nick, you did your time, but now we're not doing our time. I did mine. We're not doing our time in the field anymore. You know, Hamza is still, he has one foot in each realm and is required to have one in the construction realm in Haskell. Like, it has to work. It can't be just theoretical. And so there's these real case studies and experiences and learning that can give the feedback loop. I am behind both of you. I've actually got to get my copy. I have to be honest. I don't have my copy yet. So, but I will be grabbing it because I had him on the show and we talked about it.
Holmes, if you're listening, our starving skier up in the mountains needs a copy. So
I'll see you I'm sure I'll see you at a show somewhere here soon, Holmes. You better be carrying
those
around.
We'll get you a copy somewhere.
All right. What else you got for us?
My
Nathan?
Second one was something that our good friend Charlie Dunn had shared. I've heard about this O3 Solutions, but they did a AWP, which stands for Advanced Work Packaging Conference in Houston. And so Charlie came down, brought the Legos, did the whole song and dance. But what's cool about this one is O3 has a software that allows you to bring BIM and do all the different kind of packaging and work packaging and planning it and sequencing it. So they did all those efforts sort of in the platform alongside everyone building it in person. So to me, it was just, as someone who's always trying to bring together the concepts of building physically with Legos and those lean concepts that we're trying to teach, and how we're really trying to bring together AWP, which isn't technically, or kind of, it's loosely in the family of lean, but as they've been talking more, they're realizing that, oh yeah, it does have the same origins and they're really saying the same thing. Just one was in the energy and other industry space, and lean fell into more of the construction vertical healthcare space. But good to see that that word is getting out, that there's more of these opportunities to connect data and the right process stuff. So, Nick, I thought this was a good one for you because I feel like this is very much the world that you love to live in.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating to think about, you know, the work packet, like just how we mobilize our work teams and think about planning and staffing and schedules. Because that's really, I mean, when you get down to the meat and potatoes of construction, it's coordination. And so really figuring out, like, what equipment do I need? Who are the teams? Are they all there? Is somebody double staffed? It's a lot of moving parts. And we don't give enough credit to the schedulers who are threading eyes of needles left and right to get all the teams in the right places without stepping on each other's toes.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of cool, Nathan, coming off the ECC experience you and I had in, you know, looking at oil and gas and looking at industrial and even some of the folks that just purely do EPC style work, and how much we're all tackling very similar problems that rhyme with each other. They might have, you know, unique differences, et cetera. And yeah, they have their oranges in lean or origins in lean in other places, but you know, advanced work packaging is just a way that, that they've found to organize and deliver better. And it is really cool to see O3. I had a long conversation with Charlie about this, you know, have them be able to digitally visualize what he was doing physically. Cause so much of what we teach in workshops is the aha moment isn't really what you're doing. It's what you're not doing and how it's impacting the person across from you. Nick has experienced this and been talking about it, but a lot of those problems don't happen in person. They don't happen together. You're not in the room when you have that oh moment, but in this little workshop, you have that moment and then you go back. And if you guys haven't done this, you're going to have to come see us doing it somewhere because it's going to be continually done. These cool little events that we do and that Charlie does. He taught us a lot of it and we've all kind of jumped in to be doing it. It's those aha moments where you experience the pain that another person, usually another persona, is feeling and how what you think what you're doing is helping. And it is, right? It's coming from this place of, I want to help, I want to fix, I want to do. But it's breaking it. Like, yeah. Oh, there's no work being done over there and I want to go do the work over there. You know, but tack, that just blows it up, right? You're creating friction. So this was really cool. And I know Charlie was super stoked same thing as you, Nathan, the combination of technology and physical process.
Well, and the last point of this, I think what makes the software so unique is, Nick, you were talking earlier about, like, it's all about the data and being able to see the data. But even more than that, the relationships between the data, when you've got all the schedule data and all the BIM data and all the cost data and all the resource and labor data, and that they're actually interrelated and you can see kind of those correlations and things in some sort of a 3D model environment. Like, again, that's where those of us that have seen that light and have seen what is possible go, oh my gosh, why can't every job be like that? But once you start to unpack all the layers of how hard it is to do that, like even just on this tiny little Lego build was probably, you know, a substantial effort to get that in there, but there's so much value. And again, if we can just put that investment in up front to set it up right.
Well, yeah. And just, I know we're on the clock, but that's where all the data is important, but not all data is important to everyone. Problem starts to show its face because not everyone needs to see the work package if you're the facilities manager and just wants to know the piece of equipment. But the model is a really good way. It's a mutual language that we all understand. We can click on a thing and say, I want data associated with this object. And so that translating across that gap is really important. And that's where good data strategy becomes critical, because if we flood people with too much information, then they're not making any decisions. So how do we collect all the information, create a taxonomy for it, and make it possible for you to see what you need to see when you're looking at it?
That's very well said, because that is the importance of it. Doesn't really matter if you have it all if no one can find it, or you're overwhelmed by trying to get to it. It's got to be able to have the right information at the right time for the right person without friction. So it is really cool to see that. And, you know, so I'm excited to see that somewhere else. Hopefully we get to see that again soon. I did not keep in the realm here with Nathan as well as maybe he did with our guest. I saw this article in my weekly cybersecurity stuff, and I had to bring it up because I've been talking about it and I hate to be right sometimes, but this is from my friends at Malwarebytes Labs. AI girlfriend site breached, user fantasies stolen. So 18 plus AI companion called Mua AI was breached. And, you know, if you've got children in the car, I would keep their ears a little clear here just to say it. But these are basically sexual fantasy chat bots that have been created through this work with AI. And now all of those individuals, who they are, what they are, and now some of their deepest secrets have been stolen. and these are being used for serious extortion and other claims now knowing what they know about them. And unfortunately, the hacker who did it describes the platform as a handful of open source projects duct taped together. So I want you to think about this as you're going down your AI path. Not all AI solutions are created equal. And really, really think about what you're giving it. I took this one because I didn't want to call out a single, you know, company inside of, you know, maybe our world or even adjacent worlds. This is something that people can look at personally and realize, oh, wow, maybe I should be a little more careful, thoughtful, and planned as I start to do these kinds of things. And I know both of you are shaking your head like, uh-oh. So Nathan, I'm going to start with you on like,
I guess the first thing in my head is if I were to be a spouse that found out that the other person was on this AI girlfriend site, is that better or worse than the Ashley Madison scandal? Like what does it mean to have to be cheating on someone with an AI girlfriend? Like, is that real? Can we talk about that for a second?
I think real is in the eyes of the beholders. I think that was the point you were trying to
make, but that's where my head went.
It was not. It was not. I know that's where your head went. It was not. That's for another podcast in another realm on psychology. I immediately thought of Ashley Madison. Yeah. It's the first thing I thought of. Yeah. And Ashley Madison was doing the same thing from a security perspective. They were touting that they had it. And you don't have to believe me. Go look on Netflix. They've got a great special on it right now. You can watch the whole thing and how it went under. And they were saying all these things and they were making up the security logos, et cetera, along the way. So, Nick, as a creator of this stuff, like of technology,
not this stuff.
Sorry.
Well, what exactly does Avocado do again?
Well, at least you're going to drive traffic. I mean, all traffic's good traffic. They're going to be a little disappointed, but no, as a creator of technology and like security and knowing these things, like where does your head go? Especially because AI is just such a hype.
Yeah, I can't wait to tell Avi about our new business line. So that's for one.
That's
exciting.
Great. Way to go, Avi.
Protecting.
It's fascinating. So I have a lot of reactions to it. For one, I want to approach not necessarily AI girlfriend with an open mind, but AI communication and seeing things like Elon's dancing robots that, you know, had another guy locked in a room somewhere pretending. There is an aspect of like the loneliness epidemic as it approaches even the elderly in the world, and having a companion can probably go a long way to mental health that I don't think the three of us are nearly qualified to dig into. But interesting application, perhaps, for a technology like that. Now, I think what it does hammer home is understanding your relationship to your information, especially as a business, and what, you know, privacy and intellectual property can mean. Coming off the heels of Autodesk University, I started talking. It's like, we're going to aggregate your information so that we can create better AI tools. But what does that mean when someone else owns that platform of information? Sure, in some ways it can democratize it if everyone has access to it. But what happens if someone takes the keys away? Does somebody all of a sudden have access to a whole bunch of tribal knowledge that they now cut people off of? And so this is where I think understanding your information becomes really important. And there's also that aspect of your information is also your competitive edge. If all you do is build data centers, that knowledge, a tribal knowledge within your organization, is super valuable. And it's why people hire you, because you've built it before and you've done it before. And so there is, I think, an ethical and philosophical thing that we're going to end up crossing of what does it mean to democratize information to help raise the tides for everyone? But then also, what does it mean to create some level of security of your own unique contextual advantage that you provide as an individual within society? And so on some hands, I'm like, let's share it all, because with information, everybody can perform a little bit better. On other hands, having a good fidelity and not taking in bad data and all of those other things, it's like, we need to manage it. this, we're going to be talking about this for a decade. It's going to be wonderful.
That's a great point. Information access versus information ownership, like that. The way you pivoted that was touche. That was awesome.
I do like it. It was very good. And the other interesting thing, you hit on this, and so if other people want to go, I'm a big fan of other podcasts as well. Adam Grant's podcast, which one is this one? Work Life was on this, and he had David Dunning on from the Dunning-Kruger effect. Yes. And he actually talked about his prediction that the loneliness epidemic and the institution of things like AI chatbots that you can interact with and on a reality level is going to create a big issue. In his mind, he said he figured it out because he's very thoughtful, thinks through some odd things, and was making the OpenAI act like historical figures and then having conversations with them about modern events. And he said, then I realized I can't be the only one doing this. And this could be really dangerous if you're slipping out of reality. So another great one if you want to go listen to it. And Nathan had shared that one with me, the Dunning-Kruger effect. David Dunning, it was an awesome episode of Adam Grant's podcast.
I mean, even on that with AI voice changers, like, and this one podcast alone is probably enough to emulate us. Like, what if someone calls your mom, you know, using your voice with an AI bot? Like, we're going to need to really think about the relationship from a security standpoint we have with the world that we now live in, because the cat's not going back in the bag. It's out. So
no, the cat is out of the bag, but the cool part is hopefully we can reverse engineer it. And I predicted this earlier. We're going to have I don't know if I want to call it, Nathan, the trough of disillusionment as much as it is this storm of problems that I think actually, as we come out of it, the positive impact and skills of AI itself to police itself will create a more just and clear world. Because social media has killed us when it comes to false information. I mean, you can argue if you're left or right or center or wherever you are, but the amount of misinformation that is out there is at an all-time high, and people believe it because it is so intricately designed and built. And quite frankly, the statistics are it's coming from only about 10% of people that are actually out there that are creating this mass hysteria and misinformation campaigns. And I think AI can actually single that out and help us solve that problem at the same time.
So here's how crazy all those layers are, because the Gartner hype cycle, where you got trough of disillusionment, is based on the Dunning-Kruger effect around overconfidence. And the latest Gartner hype cycle in 2024 just put at the very peak of inflated expectations of emerging technologies, generative AI. And so generative AI does have to go through the trough of disillusionment before it can reach the slope of enlightenment and then the plateau of productivity. But they're predicting within 2 to 5 years that's going to happen, not like, you know, 30 years like it does for things like cell phone technology and things, you know, back in the day. And so like that's what's crazy is just how fast we're going through that. But yes, call it what you want, but that's what we're going through.
Yeah, you still go through the cycle, but maybe faster than ever before. And you know, that goes along with what's the other law? It's around the doubling of compute power. It's about
Moore's
thing.
Law. Like, yep.
Moore's law is kind of applying to and is part of AI. So
absolutely.
There we go. And now we're going to jump into my friends at Tech Brew. If you guys don't check out Morning Brew, they have one of their newsletters is Tech Brew. It's emergingtechbrew.com. Check it out. They have AI job openings continued to climb this year. So interestingly, that enough of this is going on in the AI world. So business is looking to hire and add this as a skill set. So if you're out on the market and you're looking to hone in, I'm not saying run away from AI. I'm actually saying run towards it and learn more about it. And so this is the skill set itself on how to use it, familiarity with the different tools that create it. There's a huge job boost in the area. So I think I wanted to balance this one with, listen, we've got to be concerned and careful, but also this is a huge opportunity. Cause like you said, Nathan, if this is going to go through its hype cycle in under 3 years, these are going to be high paying highly important jobs at different companies over time. So it's a great skill set to go learn. So I'm kind of interested, Nick, you wanted to jump in there before I'm going to put you on this one. What are your thoughts here?
I mean, I think the saying that gets thrown around is like, it's not AI that's going to replace your job, that someone with AI will. And I nail on the head. And the rationale that I have towards it is it is democratizing a lot of things, even creative things. I know people say, well, we don't want to be using AI to replace creativity. But if you've never been able to write a song before, if you've never been a good artist before, now you can draw. This is a new crayon in the crayon box, a new calculator, a new tool for you to be able to do more and contribute more as an individual. And I think people need to definitely understand that relationship. Now, I don't think it's going to replace artists. It's going to just make more artists. And so learning to compete, use your edge, all of those are things that you're going to need to learn. Thankfully, we all have AI agents that can now help us do and fill in our gaps. So I think that's a massive thing. I think the other opportunity here with AI job openings is if you've played around with AI enough, you know it hallucinates, you know it how the way you ask questions changes the way you get answers. And so being incredibly thoughtful and having people who are experts at asking the right questions is going to be critically important. And secondly, understanding the data model that's built off of. I once had a conversation with a colleague and he said, you know, I asked AI about a New Jersey rehab code and it got entirely the wrong answer. I'm like, does the AI model know New Jersey rehab code? That's oddly niche and specific. And of course it didn't. So, you know, you go load it in, then you can ask a question about it. There's that learning curve. And I think it's really important for all of us to understand that AI will have a piece in our lives. But if you're super interested in AI, becoming an expert at it, there's going to be a ton of value in a career path in that world.
Yeah. And I know there's a lot of folks out there on the market. Quietly, tech jobs are down since pre-pandemic, but they're expected to grow. And that's the cool part about this article is that, the average investment in tech jobs is going up and that they believe here at TechCrunch that the growth rate is going to really start to increase again. Nathan, thoughts?
So the one note I saw in here, around 1/3 of tech workers surveyed did not have a bachelor's degree, and kind of this whole idea of challenging the need for 4-year degrees and that whole, because again, we can argue that side on the trades and the whole value of trades versus a college degree. But even in the world of AI, it's like what is college in the world where you need to know the right questions, but you may not necessarily need to know everything else. Again, like I don't know the answer. I know those are interesting questions to philosophize about.
Oh yeah, and I think it's moving so fast now that any college course that's been created, it's not going to come out for another year. It's going to be behind the curve,
right?
So there is this need for real time understanding and real time use, but I think eventually too there will be classes that help weave this into Nick's point, mm-hmm. to the arts, to business, to marketing and science. Think about this now is like the use of a truly well-trained model to advance different scientific processes is going to need to be incorporated into the degrees that people are getting in biology and chemistry and other areas. So this is going to have a huge impact. So it doesn't matter to me where you are in the world. Now's a great opportunity to get ahead and, be out there on the forefront of learning and get yourself another edge. Plus, if you learn it, you will understand how it works and how it doesn't work. And like Nick said, it's about asking great questions and knowing what a hallucination is versus, what's some valuable information that can be gleaned from it while you're in the process.
That context is critically important. And, people aren't, AI does one thing really well. It's answer questions confidently. It might be right, it might be wrong, but it's darn well going to be confident. And for you to know what a good answer looks like or a bad answer looks like is crazy. And there was an AI tool that we saw, they basically said, someone asked, said, how quickly are you paying your contractors? So 27 days. to all of us, right? We'd be happy with a 27-day turnaround, knowing that sometimes that's 45, 60, and even north of that. So next question, guy being familiar with data science, well, tell me what the min and max was. Well, the min was negative 1,500 days, and I don't know anybody who's paying anybody 5 years or 3 years in advance. And the max was like 3,000 days, which probably someone went bankrupt. So data model was bad. And I think that's where having that ability to scrutinize and having the context to your profession is going to be something that AI will never have. It gains context as we use it, but it won't have your context. And so that's where our superpower lays, is that we have the story, we have the context, we're not going anywhere. AI can help us go faster. And it's the most important part of the relationship I want folks to understand.
Well, and maybe last point on that, just because you have success metrics doesn't mean they're the right success metrics, right? And like always scrutinizing how you are measuring and challenging if that is actually a true reflection of the value you serve or whatever like that. Those are tough questions to ask and answer in our industry, but ones we're going to have to if we're going to make it through this whole digital transformation.
Well, both of you well said. Nick, I'm going to give you a chance here. Let people know where they can go find more about that, insightful type answers, learn more about you, Avocado, et cetera.
Yeah. So if you want to find me, easiest is on LinkedIn, Nick Caravella, nothing fancy. Shoot me a message, connect with me there. I do my best to get back to everybody pretty quickly. If you want to learn about what I'm curious about, tune into Wired to Build. We're always inviting folks onto that show to have those kinds of conversations. And Avocado, AVICADO.com is the best place to find our work and what we're up to at Avocado Construction Technology Services.
Awesome. Well, excited. And I hope a few of you track him down because it's definitely worth the conversation. Nathan Wood, thank you, my friend, for sitting down with me again today.
Oh, man, this was fun. Looking forward to it again soon.
Oh, I think we will. Thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Nick Caravella. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is The Content Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.